listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As we reported earlier, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is touring the Persian Gulf. On Monday, he was in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and held a press conference with the Saudi Foreign Minister, Adel Al-Jubeir.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would like to thank my friend, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, for coming here to coordinate our efforts and strengthen our relations between our two friendly countries. This was an excellent opportunity for us to discuss, to further strengthen our relations, which over the past 4 years made good progress. And I mean both investment, trade, the economy, agriculture, space exploration, education, culture, the leadership of our two countries is happy with the way things have been developing and intend to develop our relations further. We discussed student exchange programs. We reaffirmed our commitment to offer scholarships to students from both countries to promote our ties. We also discussed the situation in the region, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the situation in Syria, Libya, Yemen. We also talked about our joint fight against terrorism. We also discussed rebuilding stability and security in the region. So once again, thank you very much for these talks. And once again, welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank my colleague and friend, Al Jabeera for, and actually all of our Saudi friends, for this close cooperation and for determination to develop our ties in line with the agreements that the leaders of our countries reached in October 2017 when King Salman met with President Putin in Moscow, and agreements between the Russian leadership and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in his numerous meetings with the Russian president. We noted improvements in our trade and economic cooperation. Trade is increasing, although we would like it to grow even quicker. And we discussed a few initiatives related to that, including our plans for the upcoming meeting of our bilateral commission for economic cooperation, which will take place shortly in the Russian capital. We also discussed the ways and the steps taken by the agencies of our two countries to coordinate new major projects in various areas like energy, peaceful use of nuclear energy, agriculture, transport, and we agreed to continue coordinating our efforts on the international oil market in the OPEC Plus format, which has been quite effective, largely due to the actions taken by Russia and Saudi Arabia. Both our countries are interested in expanding our humanitarian ties and cultural contacts. We want to cooperate more in education. Both countries are interested in that, and we are grateful to our Saudi friends for taking care of our pilgrims during the Hajj period. Our quota has been increased to 22,000 pilgrims, and security provided by Saudi Arabia deserve our highest appreciation. We also agreed that Saudi Arabia will actively participate in the work of the high-level strategic vision group created by Russia and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation called Russia Islamic World. This group annually has its meetings, and we would welcome a more active involvement of Saudi Arabia in the work of this group. We also discussed regional issue, of course, especially the Middle East and North Africa, as our top priorities of fighting terror and preventing extremist ideology from spreading. We discussed the situation in Syria, Yemen, and other areas in this extremely important region. We paid special attention to the need of making progress on the Palestinian-Israeli settlement track. The situation has been stagnant recently, and we believe that the only way to overcome this stagnation is by advancing the UN principles of peaceful settlement as part of the two-state solution. We will definitely insist that further efforts are taken based on the UN Security Council resolutions and the Arab Peace Initiative proposed by King Abdullah, the late King Abdullah. I am positive that our talks will promote ties between Russia and Saudi Arabia and will help us achieve the goals set by President Putin and King Salman. Thank you.
Mariana.
Коммерсант newspaper. I have a question for the Saudi minister. Is Riyadh going to reopen its embassy in Damascus, and is Riyadh going to invest in rebuilding Syria, especially territories controlled by the Assad government? Thank you.
Thank
Thank you very much for your question regarding reopening the embassy in Damascus. It depends on the progress we seek in the political process in Syria. And I already covered this issue a little. As regards rebuilding Syria, it's important for the war there to end. This will be an important step to rebuild stability and security in the country. And of course, together with our Arab brothers, we want to deliver humanitarian aid to Syria. We want this country to continue in its development. So we will continue doing that. I have a question for the Saudi minister. Is there any agreement on the Syrian settlement as regards our agreements? Like we said earlier, we keep talking about this issue, and we agree that this problem can only be resolved through diplomatic means. We need stability in this country, which plays such a prominent role in the Arab world. So we hope for the best in this country. Whether we agree or disagree, I'll just say we keep working. We encourage all the parties in the Syrian conflict to show understanding and seek to bring the country out of the current crisis. Thank you. Mr. Lavrov, how much time will it take to put together the list for the constitutional committee in Syria? And how much time do you think it will take to reopen the embassy in Damascus? Will you discuss this question at the upcoming meeting of the Arab League? As regards our assistance, helping the parties in Syria to put together the list for the constitutional committee, it's obvious that it's up to the parties in Syria, the government and the opposition, to sort this out. We work together with our Turkish and Iranian partners, encouraging the government and the opposition to work on this list. And this work was almost completed, but then a problem came up. As we all know, this is a totally unrelated issue. Certain difficulties created by our Western partners. And these difficulties now stand in the way of the final approval of this list by the government and the opposition. We remain calm. We will continue pursuing our goal. We still insist that Resolution 2254 has to be implemented, and we should have direct talks conducted by the people of Syria and controlled by the people of Syria. It's hard for me to give you a definite timeline, but this work is taking place, and I hope that soon we'll see it completed. By the way, I would like to take this opportunity to thank our Saudi friends. Today, through the mouth of Al Jubeir, they reaffirmed their commitment to motivate the opposition groups located in the kingdom to help with the political process. I would like to confirm that we do not have any changes in our position on reopening the embassy in Damascus. And as far as rebuilding is concerned, it's a bit of a premature question. We still need to work on that, including together with the other members of the Arab League. Question for Minister Lavrov. We see reports about France's initiative to have preliminary elections in Syria to reform the constitution and also there's a question about arms deliveries by Saudi Arabia related to the conflict in this country. Well, if it's you're referring to an initiative by France regarding preliminary election, that was the translation I heard. I don't know what you're talking about. We have a clear understanding, which has been approved by all the key players, influencing the settlement in Syria. We all agree that our primary objective is to create the constitutional committee. If certain countries who tried slowing down or creating difficulties for this process come up now with alternative proposals, that's between them and their conscience. I don't think this will help. This will serve the interests of the Syrian people, will help us serve an inclusive political process led by the UN. On arms deliveries, I didn't get the question. If you repeat your question or rephrase it, I may be able to figure out what you're referring to. As regards the arms deal involving Saudi Arabia, the suspended deal, we have agreed to review this, the details of this deal. And actually, the Canada government is still interested in this deal happening, but statements made by certain members of the Canadian government, we can't take them seriously. I have a question for Minister Lavrov. Talks between Palestinians and Israelis without any preconditions. You proposed having a meeting in Moscow. Has there been any progress on this initiative? Any new developments in the Palestinian-Israeli settlement? Well, a couple of years ago, the Israeli leadership contacted us with this idea. We talked to the Palestinian leadership. We discussed the possibility of having a meeting between the leaders of Israel and Palestine in Russia without any preconditions. The Palestinian leadership is ready for such a meeting. The Israeli leadership is still interested in this matter, but they're not sure about the timeline. So we are still ready. But this initiative, which is not actually ours, the original initiative came from Israel. We would be ready when both parties can coordinate a specific date. Now, as regards your more general question about new developments in the Palestinian-Israeli settlement, unfortunately, all I can say is all the new developments are negative. Because obviously we see attempts to undermine everything that has been done so far. I'm referring to the UN Security Council resolution, the UN General Assembly resolutions, the Arab Peace Initiative. According to the Arab Peace Plan, the Palestinian problem had to be resolved based on the two-state solution, Palestine and Israel, which live safely side by side in peace with their neighbors. And after that, all states in the League of Arab Nations. They all said that it would be ready to normalize relations with Israel. I think this is extremely important, and we actively supported the Arab peace plan, which was put forth, like I said earlier today, by the late King Abdullah. Currently, we see attempts to overturn this initiative and first have normalization between Arab states and Israel, and then after that consider whether something could be done for the Palestinians. We pointed out that our U.S. partners working on the so-called deal of the century, when asked directly, started saying that they're not trying to undermine the two-state solution, yet we have reasons to believe that such statements, well, at least we have to verify them. Let's see what the final plan eventually looks like. But we are convinced, and this is what we discussed with our Saudi friends today, is that the Arab peace plan should remain as it was put forward in the first place. You can't use the Palestinian problem to play with it against existing agreements, against what has been achieved in the UN and as part of direct contact between the two parties. We need a fair solution to the Palestinian problem, among other things, to counter the trend of extremism spreading in the Arab world. This is a very serious matter, and I hope that those directly involved in this work are aware of the special responsibility on their shoulders for any decisions they are about to take and the consequences that such decisions might have.
Noor Gnabry from Arab News. Minister Lavrov, I do have a question. You said that you were talking about developing nuclear energy with Saudi Arabia. Can you elaborate more on this, and what did you reach or conclude on, and if you have anyone? Also, Mr. Adil Jubeir, if you'd like to add anything.
Saudi Arabia has a peaceful nuclear program, and under this program there is a tender to build nuclear facilities, and Russian government corporation Rosatom takes part in this tender, in this contest. It passed the first round, and now it's in the second round of this tender. I hope that the experience that Russian nuclear specialists have accumulated over the years and the high level of safety that Russian nuclear companies can ensure will be properly appreciated by our Saudi friends. I think Mr. Minister gave a full answer to your question. As regards this intentions by Saudi Arabia to develop peaceful nuclear energy, we certainly want to get the best possible technology and a high level of safety. So we'll keep moving in this direction. Thank you.
As Black Agenda Radio reports this week, the South American nation of Venezuela has held more elections in the past 20 years than any other nation in the Western Hemisphere and, perhaps, the entire world. But corporate media and both political parties in the U.S. insist that Venezuela's socialist government is a dictatorship. The U.S. has seized billions in Venezuelan assets, and the Trump administration is now threatening military action. Afia Mwangaza is a lawyer and director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina. Mwangaza was among the international observers who verified Venezuela's elections as free and fair, and spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
Not only do I take this position, but former President, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, also takes the position that Venezuela has the most transparent and cleanest elections of any country in the world. So much so that the Carter Center almost doesn't even bother about going anymore because that description has not changed. When I participated as in the observer delegation last May, which happened to be Malcolm X's birthday weekend, I was utterly amazed at the transparency, the access, and the certification process. We know that the first thing that we experienced was the opportunity to examine the hardware. The hardware was designed in collaboration with Venezuelan engineers and Chinese manufacturers. The software was the same thing. They showed us exactly, piece by piece, how it worked. When we go looking at the software has internal safety measures and checks and has a verification process that any citizen can walk off the street in his or her polling place and demand not only an audit, but also demand an examination and certification of the software as his or her vote is being processed, ballot is being processed. I want to go to access. In this country, we know voter suppression is an industry in and of itself. In Venezuela, it's just the opposite. The government takes every effort to make sure that folk are able to vote. In fact, when someone turns 18 years old, they are automatically registered and eligible to vote. And that, I would point out, is without regard for one's, for lack of a better term, criminal punishment status. Further, all candidates have an equal amount of free time on media, television, radio. Print is different because print is privately owned. All campaigning on that level ends 2 weeks before the election. So we have voters having ready automatic access to the polls, the franchise. We have candidates having full, unfettered, uncostly, free access to the public through the media. And on the day of the election itself, there are polling places everywhere. The only place that I saw a line to vote was on the military bases. In the neighborhoods, people come in, they identify themselves, everyone has their identity card, they present their identity card, the first machine has their thumbprint, which is electronically attached to their identity card and a picture of them and their identity card appears in response to their thumbprint. So it's very clear that the person who is voting is the person who is supposed to be voting. They go from that station to the next station where essentially the same process occurs and they sign themselves into the polling place. They go from that station to the ballot itself, which is a combination of pictures and letter narrative. And it really reminded me very much of our voting literacy program in the South during the 60s, especially in Lowndes County, where the Black Panther was used as the symbol to not only to embody the spirit of the campaign, but also to overcome the high illiteracy rate of the community with which we were dealing. So you have that same kind of concern and solution in Venezuela. Once the ballot has been marked, and here the people actually, they vote for the party as opposed to voting for the individual. But once they have cast their ballot, then the ballot prints out a receipt, just like you get at the at an ATM machine. Then that receipt is compared with, you can compare it with what your recollection is of how you voted and whether or not it's reflected in the process as represented by the receipt. Here in South Carolina, we have a paperless system where even elected officials have objected to having cast a vote, chosen a candidate, and another candidate's name come up. This has gone on for at least the past 20 years without change. And now the Republican administration, and it's not limited, frankly, to the Republicans or the Democrats, to the Republicans, because the Democrats are no better, have said, okay, we're going to change the machines because they're old, they're malfunctioning, and we need the money to change the system with a paper ballot, to have a paper, at least a receipt, so that we can go back and look. See if it's for consistency. Now, last week, they've announced that they can't do that because they don't have enough money to do that, but they're so concerned about democracy, right? In Venezuela, at the end of the day, the managers and the polling managers must take a tally of the signatures. They must take a tally of the thumb imprints. They must take a tally of the ballots themselves. They must take a tally of the outcome of the ballots. All of this is done in full public view. You can stand there right beside the poll managers and watch everything they do, not from across the room, right beside them. All of those tallies must match. If they do not match, they have to go through the process all over again. And any citizen in that polling place can say, I don't like what that looks like. I want to see this section of it, or I want to see the whole thing. And it has to be redone. Now, in the United States, you can't even get to where they tally the votes.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Adam Smith, the forefather of modern economics, once said that resentment is the safeguard of justice and the security of innocence. The latest wave of resentment that produced Brexit and Donald Trump is often discounted as populism or Russia's plotting, but isn't it an inevitable and authentically Western response to the injustices and abuses of globalization? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Frank-Jürgen Richter, founder and chairman of Harassis, the Global Visions Community. Mr. Richter, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Many thanks for having me.
Now, I know that you worked for a number of European multinationals in China. You saw globalization up close and personal, and you usually speak very favorably about it. But I wonder if that's not a vantage point bias. If you happen to observe it, let's say from the American Midwest, wouldn't your views be a little bit different?
We are currently experiencing a crisis of globalization. A deep-seated resentment of globalization is boiling over worldwide. A great portion of the world is perceiving themselves as globalization losers. This resentment is best exemplified by the Yellow Vest movement in France, but also by the rise of Donald Trump. And I guess most of those who voted for Donald Trump are globalization losers.
One of the things that we usually hear about globalization is that it lifted millions of people out of poverty. And that is undeniable. Nobody argues with that. But if you happen to be head of a multinational company, it would have also benefited your bank account in very, very generous ways. Whereas if you're a blue-collar worker who saw his factory closed and a shopping mall opened in its place, would the benefits of globalization be just as apparent?
Well, globalization is here to stay. There's no doubt about it. But I think we have to redefine globalization and maybe catalyze the benefits of globalization. You put it right, Oksana. The Anglo-Saxon model of capitalism and globalization is in crisis. Even so, we have seen economic growth over the last few decades. Not everybody is benefiting from globalization. We see a shrinking of the middle class in America and in Europe. And even so, on the surface, there's a lot of economic success. The middle class is shrinking and less people who can really benefit from globalization.
Well, let's talk about why that happened. Globalization clearly has benefited export-oriented economies like China or Germany much more and much more evenly than import-oriented economies, including the United States. Is it really surprising then that the pushback against globalization or the current form of globalization would originate in America? Wasn't it bound to occur there?
Yeah, we see this backlash on globalization and the discontent of globalization, especially in U.S. You put it right again. America is mostly importing goods from Germany, for example, cars, and from China, fast-moving consumer goods. And, of course, America is very strong in the tech sector, but it lost its manufacturing sector. I guess America will never be in the position to revive its manufacturing sector. It's too late. It's too late now to build steel mills like in the past. We see this division of world of work worldwide, and America should focus on technology. I believe that the current American administration is making a big mistake trying to rebalance imports and exports, now starting a trade war with China, but also with Germany and other European countries. And I think this trade war will really lead to disaster and ultimately even to an economic crisis.
But why are you saying it's too late to try to rebalance the distribution of labor around the world? Because it's not just about jobs, it's also about local taxes. And in the United States, schools, local infrastructure are funded by local taxes. So if you bring a factory from overseas and place it somewhere in Ohio, that would have a ripple effect throughout the community. It's not just about, you know, pleasing the Trump's base in terms of giving them jobs, but also helping the local economy.
In theory, yes, of course, it would be feasible, but I think it's too late because, you know, the cost in America is just too high. It's much more economic to manufacture in China and partly even in Germany because Germany got a very performance-oriented economy and it's able to churn out cars and other products at a reasonable price. America is not able to do so, and the whole American economy actually is based on loans. People are not really putting money aside. The domestic saving rate is around 20%. In comparison, it's around 45% in China. So it will never happen again. I think it's a lost game.
Well, but the status quo also seems to be rather untenable. And you can see that by the change of the American political spectrum, because it's not just about Trump. His opponents on the left, people like Bernie Sanders, are essentially talking about the same problem of domesticating the wealth, but they have a different way of going about it, increasing the taxes on the rich. Which of these two ways you find more economically viable?
Well, I would always go for like a centrist approach, avoiding the very far left and the very far left, right, but something in the middle. I agree that we have to give back to the losers of globalization and to have to increase taxes. I'm not looking into communism. I'm not looking into socialism, but I believe that we have to create a more inclusive world. And yes, we have to increase taxes, always reducing taxes is not helping anybody because we have to build infrastructure, hospitals, kindergarten, and of course we need tax income for that.
Now, you are the chairman of the Horacis Forum, which brings each year leaders from all over the world to talk about those issues. And I know that the upcoming meeting in April is going to be dedicated to, quote, discussing a morally decent form of globalization. Does it mean that globalization as it stands right now is morally indecent?
Yes, we are hosting the Horacis Global Meeting in Cascais in Portugal in early April with around 800 participants, including four head of states and 15 ministers, and we'll debate the future of globalization and maybe providing a moral compass for it. I think globalization lost its moral compass, and maybe we have to put more values into the system. My personal opinion is we have to strengthen multilateral institutions. Now we are living in a doc-e-doc world. It's like a lose-lose game, having always, action and counteraction. So we need to put values back to the system, and we need stronger leadership and better leadership.
Well, it's interesting to me that you mentioned this moral issue, because there are lots of moralizing about Trump's economic slogans, putting America first, making America great again, and that's all dismissed as populism, but don't they deserve a substantial, serious discussion about how globalization has essentially been able to free the wealth from any national affiliation and any social responsibility that comes with it? Don't you find it striking that globalization is now being discussed in moral terms rather than economic terms?
I agree. I think we need a new theory. When you go to the business schools, if you go to MIT and Harvard and Stanford, you're learning about theories of the past. I think we have to adopt our economic models, and we have to talk about the moral compass behind globalization. And we have to avoid a lose-lose scenario. We have to avoid also a win-lose scenario. I think we should always look into dialogue where we can always harmonize our different opinions, where we can find compromise. And at the end of the day, having everybody winning from globalization. So we need a new theory, and we meet in Cascais in April at the closing plenary. We will propose an action plan how to make it happen.
Well, I think you laid out some of your ideas in your article already, and you suggested, for example, that for globalization to work for the masses, one way would be to break the cycle of political short-termism by extending electoral terms. If Trump were to take your advice, what kind of reaction do you think that would provoke in the United States?
You know, in Europe and US, usually we exchange precedents just in a short-term mood and mode. And if you look into the Chinese system, for example, it's much more long-term oriented. And I would even quote the Russian system in this regard. It's more long-term oriented. And I think we have to extend the term of presidents and prime ministers in power. I'm not saying that Trump should stay in power forever. Of course, it's a political decision. But I'm saying that in general, we need longer terms. Usually, Western prime ministers coming in the first year, just adjusting things, maybe in the second year, trying to lay down a long-term strategy. And from the third year on, he's starting again to think about re-election. So we need a long-term orientation. We need to think about the future. We have to invest in education. We have to invest in technology as well. The Chinese now are leaders in artificial intelligence because they have a very long-term oriented strategy.
But Mr. Richter, don't you think that what you're suggesting is a major heresy to a lot of liberal thinkers, suggesting that non-democracies, and I'm putting it mildly, you know, Russia and China are usually described in different terms, suggesting that those countries have something to teach the West?
Well, I think we shouldn't teach each other, neither the West to China and Russia, nor the other way around, but we can learn from each other. And maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle. I'm saying that democracy is still the best form of governance, but we need to think about democracy in a different term, where we can have long-term decisions and not just short-term actions. Think about the economy. When Trump boosted the economy 2 years ago, propose in tax cuts. Of course, we have seen an economic growth of 3%, but now we are reaching and experiencing a bubble. That's not long-term economic strategy. It's really short-term orientation. And it's maybe the reason of the failure of the so-called Anglo-Saxon model of capitalism.
Now, we mentioned Russia before, so let me ask one more question about Russia and Trump, because Trump is sometimes presented as a Russian creation. But if we look at the economic fundamentals, which we mentioned actually before, the shrinking of the middle class in the United States, the huge trade deficit, the enormous exacerbation of wealth inequalities, which in the United States is much wider than in other Western countries, doesn't it all make Trump a uniquely American, an authentically American phenomenon, him responding to a unique set of effects that globalization has on the United States?
Right. It's a very American approach, of course, keeping government very small. It's a very libertarian approach, of course. Maybe America should not go to the left with the Bernie Sanders approach, but maybe try to copy the Northern European model of capitalism, what we usually have in Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Finland. Here, actually, democracy and globalization has found the right way. It's like a middle way, a lot of compromise. Finland, for example, experienced also with a monthly guaranteed income for everybody. And I think that's the way to go. It's a mix between freewheeling capitalism and democracy and maybe a bit more of socialism. And here, I think the West can indeed learn more from countries like China and Russia.
Economically, that sounds very appealing, but do you think it is reasonable politically? Do you think it's achievable politically given the level of political polarization in the United States?
It's definitely a polarization, and we can either choose candidates from the very left or we can choose Trump. And I think the center is kind of disappearing, both the moderated Republicans and Democrats. And I can only hope that a candidate can come up who will unite American people and will be electable by both parts of the ocean.
Okay, well, Mr. Richter, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Frank-Jürgen Richter, chairman at Horasys. Mr. Richter, just before the break, we started talking about how differently countries are affected by globalization, depending on whether they rely more on imports or exports. How would that change that definition of free and fair trade? And doesn't Trump have a point, an economic point, when he says that what's free trade for China or Germany is not necessarily fair trade for the United States?
The reason why Trump is launching the trade war in China, it's definitely linked to his view that China is not really playing according to the rules in terms of free trade and fair trade. He always believes that the Chinese economy is fully supported by state-owned company, cheap loans, and also national interest. Definitely, you know, there's some truth to it. There's still very large state-owned companies in China, but the current economic growth and the economic miracle of China is mostly due to the private sector. Companies like Huawei, Alibaba, or Tencent. And those are really the stars. And I think Trump is here missing the point, because already now and already today, China is very much an open economy with very strong private sector.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, we've seen the Chinese make some concessions, but I think they're pretty modest compared to the American, or at least Trump's, grievances with China. There are people within the Trump administration who take issue not just with Chinese trade practices, but with the entire nature of its economic system, as you just pointed out. Do you think the Trump administration will limit itself to just, you know, tariff and trade concessions, or will they go further? Will they try to reshape China's entire economic model?
Well, Trump put an extension to the tariffs, so we don't really know what's happening. I would say it's like a 50-50 chance that a full-fledged trade war is really happening, and hopefully there will be some truce and finally an agreement. But yes, it's not only trade, it's not only the deficit America is experiencing, but the whole economic and political model. I think U.S. and Trump are identifying China as the next big enemy. It's actually not Russia, it's China. And China is certainly challenging America economically. We have such a strong economy in China, and I believe that China is a new engine of global economic growth, and China will write economic history.
Mm-hmm. You often say in your interviews that China is now the driver of globalization, and I've heard other economists suggest that the future of capitalism now depends as much on the Communist Party of China as it historically depended on the Democrats or the Republicans. Do you think China has what it needs to drive capitalism in the right direction?
Well, when President Xi Jinping came to Europe 2 years ago, he talked about globalization, said China is defending globalization. And a counterpart to what President Trump is saying is the American policy is more and more retrenching, is more and more taking an isolationistic view. I believe the Chinese leadership is very wise. China is experiencing some economic problems right now. Economic growth might be redefined to 6%, currently is at 6.5%. Next week, actually, the NPC, the National People's Congress, is gathering and talking about those economic measures. But China is about to change gears. Now they're re-leveraging the economy, and they're playing with fiscal measures to reboost the economy, providing more loans and deal flow, more infrastructure. I see that China is on the right track, and they have the right toolbox.
You said just a moment ago that China is defending globalization, but it's defending the kind of globalization that you, in your own report, by implication, called morally indecent. That's a very self-serving or China-serving form of globalization that does not benefit other countries equally. Do you think the Chinese will also have to come to terms that the current model that exists today will have to be changed?
Well, the Chinese are taking more and more part in global institutions. Think about, the World Bank, the IMF, the IFC. They are even developing their own international institutions like the Asia Infrastructure Investment Development Bank and others. So they're good global citizens. And I know that China is no longer isolated and have to take part in global dialogue. And they're part of the whole globalization game. They also understand that globalization should be a win-win game. Think about what the Chinese are doing in Africa. They're investing heavily in infrastructure. They're heavily investing also in education in Africa. It's good for the continent. It's good, of course, for China on the long term as well. And I think globalization is always benefit both sides. And Chinese got the moral compass. I think they know that they just can't do things on their own. And they are changing even now the investment climate. In the past, foreign investors in China faced some difficulties when it came to unfair competition. Foreign companies had to establish joint venture companies, have to transfer technology. But China is changing this right now. And we will learn more next week when the NPC is meeting about this new China and China's new economic policies.
Now, Mr. Richter, I heard you say with regards to Trump that the Chinese should do what they do best, that is just sit and wait. U.S. presidents, as you said, come and go. The Chinese leadership stays. Why are you so sure that this anti-China, anti-globalization streak will disappear once Trump leaves office? Because it was there even before him, perhaps not so vocally expressed, but it was definitely there.
Yes, there was always a lot of China bashing in U.S., but also in Europe. And I think America and Europe are building something like a Chinese wall, right? And to bashing the Chinese and trying to limit imports from the Chinese. What we experienced, for example, with Huawei, the Chinese tech company, really is exemplifying this attitude. But I think America and Europe shouldn't do that. And on the the long term, you know, once Trump is gone and a new president is there, I think we should rethink our approach to China and find the right modus operandi where we can collaborate. And we shouldn't compete on trade. We should always try to be good partners and stop this China bashing.
Now, you mentioned Europe, and I think Europe is caught a bit in the middle here, because politically and militarily, it's still associated with the United States, but it economically benefits globalization in ways similar to China. Which magnet is likely to prove stronger, and do you think Europe will remain united as it navigates these competing pools?
Well, Europe currently is in a deep crisis, in a deep institutional crisis. Not only Brexit, but the whole framework of the European Union. But I think this may be crisis leading to catharsis. Finally, Europe is redefining itself, and Europe will be stronger under French-German leadership. I think Europe will be strongly united, and China will be a very strong partner of Europe. Already now, China is Germany's largest trading partner. Volkswagen, for example, the German car company, has China as its main market, and many other German and European companies as well. So, yes, Europe is in between America and China, and I think it's a good position. That shouldn't really take sides. That should work with both sides, and we should also include Russia. I believe it's good to collaborate. I'm just repeating my word before. We need more dialogue. And we should stop this confrontation.
Well, I think that position in the middle is good if you use it smartly. But if we look at what's happening in Europe, inequalities in terms of economic development within the EU are still pretty wide. There is a growing feeling of resentment in the South against the North. There are tensions between the East and the West of Europe, not only about doing business with China, but as you said, doing business with Russia. What would it take for the EU to stay together when economic interests of its members are increasingly diverging?
You're right. We see the divergence between the East, the West, the North and the South. Talking about the South, I'm very concerned about Italy. Italy's economy might go into a recession maybe in the third quarter this year, and maybe in a longer economic crisis, tracking down the whole European Union. And Italy is not Greece. Greece, what we experienced 10 years ago when the first economic crisis hit, was a much smaller, of course, patient, so to say. What can we do? I think we need more inclusion. We have to listen to the Italians. We have to listen to the Eastern Europeans. We just can't go saying it's a Western European approach. We need to listen to those having issues here and find a united voice. I think Europe has always been very strong having this united voice, and we need maybe a new leadership in Europe. Leaders who are true Europeans, who can think about a united continent with strong relations to America, to China, and to Russia.
Well, good leadership is always the best solution for everything. The question is where to find it. I mean, I think there are many countries around the world that are really struggling with on that issue. Can I ask you something different, though? Because many people, when they talk about those issues, they present globalization and protectionism as if they are totally incompatible. But there are many countries that do both. China is both globalist and protectionist at the same time. So is India, so is the United States. Is it really about this tension between globalization and protectionism, as opposed to the need to redefine the rules of global trade, make them accessible and fair to everybody, and make them reflect the current realities of the global economy?
You know, I believe that protectionism in some very specific areas is the right thing to do. If you think about the farming sector, and what many African countries experience right now is that their own agricultural sector is suffering, and they're importing tomatoes and even meat from the European Union. So this shouldn't be the case. I think we need some self-sufficiency here, especially in the agricultural sector. But everything else should be open. Everything else should be linked to the division of labor. And we need also a free movement of people. Talking about the phenomena of migration, I think migration is good for countries. Think about the Silicon Valley in the U.S. Most tech pioneers in the U.S. Are migrants, first generation or second generation.
But Mr. Richter, the Silicon Valley is attracting the cream of the crop, people who go there on their own accord and who would succeed in any country. Is it really comparable to a mass and often uncontrolled migration of millions of people whose identities you are not always able to check and whose skill set is very, very different from that of the Silicon Valley engineers?
I think we need them as well. There's a labor shortage in countries like Germany. And, you know, look about the birth rate in countries like Germany, Italy. So we need migration in all levels for the highly educated engineers and tech pioneers, but also for those with much less education. And I think the rich countries of the West have to support those migrants, those looking for exile and those coming over, and help them to find their dreams, maybe investing also in their own education and helping them to grow. I think that's the right way to go. So the world should work together, and it shouldn't be a dog-eat-dog mentality.
Okay, Mr. Richter, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate you being with us today and sharing your perspective.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages, and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.